2. Hi, Samantha. Max, is that you? Who else? Leon said that Auntie Sammy called when I was in the shower. We had a good talk. He's such a sweet kid. Yeah, I think I'll keep him. A moment of discomfort for both of them, barely a crackle of a whisper over the telephone lines, then... Sammy, how's school? They're giving us a week off. Problem with the furnaces. How are things in your neck of the North Woods? Well, I've got a new next-door neighbor. He does coin tricks. The Lakeside Newsletter column currently features a blistering debate on the potential rezoning of the town land down by the old cemetery on the southeast shore of the lake, and yours truly has to write a strident editorial summarizing the paper's position on this without offending anybody or in fact giving anyone any idea what our position is. Sounds like fun. It's not. Allison McGovern vanished last week. Jillian Stan McGovern's oldest. Nice kid. She babysat for Leon a few times. A mouth opens to say something, and it closes again, leaving whatever it was to say unsaid, and instead it says, "That's awful." Yes. So, and there's nothing to follow that with that isn't going to hurt, so she says, "Is he cute?" "Who?" "The neighbor." "His name's Ainsel, Mike Ainsel. He's okay. Too young for me. Big guy. Looks... what's the word? Begins with an M. Mean? Moody? Magnificent? Married?" A short laugh, then, "Yes, I guess he does look married. I mean, if there's a look that married men have, he kind of has it. But the word I was thinking of was melancholy. He looks melancholy." "And mysterious?" "Not particularly. When he moved in, he seemed kinda helpless. He didn't even know how to heat-seal the windows. These days he still looks like he doesn't know what he's doing here. When he's here, he's here, then he's gone again. I've seen him out walking from time to time." "Maybe he's a bank robber." "Uh-huh, just what I was thinking." "You were not. That was my idea. Listen, Mags, how are you? Are you okay?" "Yeah." "Really?" "No." A long pause, then. "I'm coming up to see you." "Sammy, no. It'll be after the weekend, before the furnaces are working and school starts again. It'll be fun. You can make up a bed on the couch for me and invite the mysterious neighbor over for dinner one night." "Sam, you're matchmaking." "Who's matchmaking? After Claudine the bitch from hell, maybe I'm ready to go back to boys for a while. I met a nice strange boy when I hitchhiked down to El Paso for Christmas." "Oh, look, Sam, you've got to stop hitchhiking." "How do you think I'm going to get to Lakeside?" "Allison McGovern was hitchhiking. Even in a town like this, it's not safe. I'll wire you the money. You can take the bus." "I'll be fine, Sammy." "Okay, Mags. Wire me the money if it'll let you sleep easier." "You know it will." "Okay, bossy big sister. Give Leon a hug and tell him Auntie Sammy's coming up, and he's not to hide his toys in her bed this time." "I'll tell him. I don't promise it'll do any good." "So when should I expect you?" "Tomorrow night. You don't have to meet me at the bus station. I'll ask Hinselman to run me over in Tessie." "Too late. Tessie's in mothballs for the winter, but Hinselman will give you a ride anyway. He likes you. You listen to his stories." "Maybe you should get Hinselman to write your editorial for you. Let's see. On the rezoning of the land by the old cemetery, it so happens that in the winter of '03, my grandpa shot a stag down by the old cemetery by the lake. He was out of bullets, so he used a cherry stone from the lunch my grandmama had packed for him, creased the skull of the stag, and it shot off like a bat out of heck. 2 years later, he was down that way, and he sees this mighty buck with a spreading cherry tree growing between its antlers. Well, he shot it, and Grandmama made cherry pies enough that they were still eating them come the next 4th of July.
And they both laughed. Then. Interlude 3. Jacksonville, Florida. 2 a.m.
The sign says help wanted.
"We're always hiring."
"I can only work the night shift. Is that going to be a problem?"
"Shouldn't be. I can get you an application to fill out. You ever worked in a gas station before?"
"No." "I figure how hard can it be?"
"Well, it ain't rocket science, that's for sure. You know, ma'am, you don't mind my saying this, but you do not look well."
I know. It's a medical condition. Looks worse than it is. Nothing life-threatening.
Okay. You leave that application with me. We are really short-handed on a late shift right now. Round here we call it the zombie shift. You do it too long, that's how you feel. Well, now, is that Larna?
Laura.
Laura. Okay. Well, I hope you don't mind dealing with weirdos, because they come out at night.
I'm sure they do. I can cope.
Chapter 13. Hey, old friend. What do you say, old friend? Make it okay, old friend. Give an old friendship a break. Why so grim? We're going on forever. You, me, him. Too many lives are at stake. Stephen Sondheim, Old Friends. It was Saturday morning. Shadow answered the door. Marguerite Olsen was there. She didn't come in, just stood there in the sunlight, looking serious.
Mr. Ainsel?
Mike, please, said Shadow.
Mike, yes, would you like to come over for dinner tonight, about six-ish? It won't be anything exciting, just spaghetti and meatballs.
I like spaghetti and meatballs.
Obviously, if you have any other plans...
I have no other plans.
6 o'clock.
Should I bring flowers?
If you must. But this is a social gesture, not a romantic one.
He showered. He went for a short walk, down to the bridge and back. The sun was up, a tarnished quarter in the sky, and he was sweating in his coat by the time he got home. He drove the Forerunner down to Dave's Finest Food and bought a bottle of wine. It was a $20 bottle, which seemed to Shadow like some kind of guarantee of quality. He didn't know wines, so he bought a Californian Cabernet, because Shadow had once seen a bumper sticker back when he was younger and people still had bumper stickers on their cars, which said, "Life is a Cabernet," and it had made him laugh. He bought a plant in a pot as a gift. Green leaves, no flowers. Nothing remotely romantic about that. He bought a carton of milk, which he would never drink, and a selection of fruit, which he would never eat. Then he drove over to Mabel's and bought a single lunchtime pasty. Mabel's face lit up when she saw him.
"Did Hinselman catch up with you?"
I didn't know he was looking for me.
"Yep, wants to take you ice fishing. And Chad Mulligan wanted to know if I'd seen you around. His cousin's here from out of state. His second cousin, what we used to call kissing cousins. Such a sweetheart. You'll love her."
And she dropped the pasty into a brown paper bag, twisted the top over to keep the pasty warm. Shadow drove the long way home, eating one-handed, the pastry crumbs tumbling onto his jeans and onto the floor of the Forerunner. He passed the library on the south shore of the lake. It was a black-and-white town in the ice and the snow. Spring seemed unimaginably far away. The clunker would always sit on the ice with the ice-fishing shelters and the pickup trucks and the snowmobile tracks. He reached his apartment, parked, walked up the drive, up the wooden steps to his apartment. The goldfinches and nuthatches on the bird feeder hardly gave him a glance. He went inside. He watered the plant, wondered whether or not to put the wine into the refrigerator. There was a lot of time to kill until 6. Shadow wished he could comfortably watch television once more. He wanted to be entertained, not to have to think, just to sit and let the sounds and the light wash over him.
"Do you want to see Lucy's tits?"
Something with a Lucy voice whispered in his memory, and he shook his head, although there was no one there to see him. He was nervous, he realized. This would be his first real social interaction with other people, normal people, not people in jail, not gods or culture heroes or dreams, since he was first arrested over 3 years ago. He would have to make conversation as Mike Ainsel. He checked his watch. It was 2:30. Marguerite Olsen had told him to be there at 6. Did she mean 6 exactly? Should he be there a little early, a little late? He decided, eventually, to walk next door at 6:05. Shadow's telephone rang.
"Yeah," he said. "That's no way to answer the phone," growled Wednesday.
When I get my telephone connected, I'll answer it politely, said Shadow. Can I help you?
I don't know, said Wednesday. There was a pause, then he said, organizing gods is like herding cats into straight lines. They don't take naturally to it.
There was a deadness and an exhaustion in Wednesday's voice that Shadow had never heard before.
What's wrong? It's hard. It's too fucking hard. I don't know if this is going to work. We might as well cut our throats. Just cut our own throats.
You mustn't talk like that.
Yeah, right.
Well, if you do cut your throat, said Shadow, trying to jolly Wednesday out of his darkness, maybe it wouldn't even hurt.
It would hurt. Even for my kind, pain still hurts. If you move and act in the material world, then the material world acts on you. Pain hurts, just as greed intoxicates and lust burns. We may not die easy, and we sure as hell don't die well, but we can die. If we're still loved and remembered, something else a whole lot like us comes along and takes our place, and the whole damn thing starts all over again. And if we're forgotten, we're done.
Shadow didn't know what to say. He said, So where are you calling from?
None of your goddamn business.
Are you drunk?
Not yet. I just keep thinking about Thor. You never knew him. Big guy, like you. Good-hearted. Not bright. But he'd give you the goddamn shirt off his back if you asked him. And he killed himself. He put a gun in his mouth and blew his head off in Philadelphia in 1932. What kind of a way is that for a god to die?
I'm sorry.
You don't give two fucking cents, son. He was a whole lot like you, big and dumb.
Wednesday stopped talking. He coughed.
What's wrong? Said Shadow for the second time. They got in touch.
Who did?
The opposition.
And?
They want to discuss a truce, peace talks. Live and let fucking live.
So what happens now?
Now I go and drink bad coffee with the modern assholes in a Kansas City Masonic Hall.
Okay. You going to pick me up or shall I meet you somewhere?
You stay there and keep your head down. Don't get into any trouble, you hear me?
But there was a click. And the line went dead and stayed dead. There was no dial tone, but then there never had been. Nothing but time to kill. The conversation with Wednesday had left Shadow with a sense of disquiet. He got up, intending to go for a walk, but already the light was fading, and he sat back down again. Shadow picked up the minutes of the Lakeside City Council, 1872 to 1884, and turned the pages, his eyes scanning the tiny print, not actually reading it, occasionally stopping to scan something that caught his eye. In July 1874, Shadow learned, the city council was concerned about the number of itinerant foreign loggers arriving in the town. An opera house was to be built on the corner of 3rd Street and Broadway. It was to be expected that the nuisances attendant to the damming of the Mill Creek would abate once the mill pond had become a lake. The council authorized the payment of $70 to Mr. Samuel Samuels and of $85 to Mr. Heikki Salminen in compensation for their land and for the expenses incurred in moving their domiciles out of the area to be flooded. It had never occurred to Shadow before that the lake was man-made. Why call a town Lakeside when the lake had begun as a dammed mill pond? He read on to discover that a Mr. Hinselman, originally of Hudemühlen in Bavaria, was in charge of the lake-building project, and that the city council had granted him the sum of $370 toward the project, any shortfall to be made up by public subscription. Shadow tore off a strip of paper towel and placed it into the book as a bookmark. He could imagine Hinselman's pleasure in seeing the reference to his grandfather. He wondered if the old man knew that his family had been instrumental in building the lake. Shadow flipped forward through the book, scanning for more references to the lake-building project. They had dedicated the lake in a ceremony in the spring of 1876 as a precursor to the town's centennial celebrations. A vote of thanks to Mr. Hinzelman was taken by the council. Shadow checked his watch. It was 5:30. He went into the bathroom, shaved, combed his hair. He changed his clothes. Somehow the final 15 minutes passed. He got the wine and the plant, and he walked next door. The door opened as he knocked. Marguerite Olsen looked almost as nervous as he felt. She took the wine bottle and the potted plant and said thank you. The television was on, The Wizard of Oz on video. It was still in sepia, and Dorothy was still in Kansas, sitting with her eyes closed in Professor Marvel's wagon as the old fraud pretended to read her mind, and the twister wind that would tear her away from her life was approaching. Leon sat in front of the screen, playing with a toy fire truck. When he saw Shadow, an expression of delight touched his face. He stood up and ran, tripping over his feet in his excitement, into a back bedroom from which he emerged a moment later, triumphantly waving a quarter.
"Watch, Mike Ainsell!" he shouted.
Then closed both his hands, and he pretended to take the coin into his right hand, which he opened wide.
"I made it disappear, Mike Ainsell!"
"You did," agreed Shadow. "After we've eaten, if it's okay with your mom, I'll show you how to do it even smoother than that."
"Do it now, if you want," said Marguerite. "We're still waiting for Samantha. I sent her out for sour cream. I don't know what's taking her so long."
And as if that was her cue, footsteps sounded on the wooden deck, and somebody shouldered open the front door. Shadow didn't recognize her at first. Then she said,
"I didn't know if you wanted the kind with calories or the kind that tastes like wallpaper paste, so I went for the kind with calories."
And he knew her then. The girl from the road to Cairo.
"That's fine," said Marguerite. "Sam, this is my neighbor, Mike Ainsell. Mike, this is Samantha Black Crow, my sister."
"I don't know you," thought Shadow desperately. "You've never met me before. We're total strangers." He tried to remember how he had thought snow, how easy and light that had been. This was desperate. He put out his hand and said, "Pleased to meet you." She blinked, looked up at his face. A moment of puzzlement, then recognition entered her eyes and curved the corners of her mouth into a grin.
"Hello," she said. "I'll see how the food is doing," said Marguerite, in the taut voice of someone who burns things in kitchens if they leave them alone and unwatched even for a moment. Sam took off her puffy coat and her hat.
"So you're the melancholy but mysterious neighbor," she said. "Who'd have thunk it?"
She kept her voice down. "And you," he said, "are Girl Sam. Can we talk about this later?"
"If you promise to tell me what's going on."
"Deal." Leon tugged at the leg of Shadow's pants.
"Will you show me now?"
he asked, and held out his quarter. "Okay," said Shadow. "But if I show you, you have to remember that a master magician never tells anyone how it's done."
"I promise," said Leon, gravely.
Shadow took the coin in his left hand, then moved Leon's right hand, showing him how to appear to take the coin in his right hand while actually leaving it in Shadow's left hand. Then he made Leon repeat the movements on his own. After several attempts, the boy mastered the move. "Now you know half of it," said Shadow. "The other half is this. Put your attention on the place where the coin ought to be. Look at the place it's meant to be. If you act like it's in your right hand, no one will even look at your left hand, no matter how clumsy you are." Sam watched all this with her head tipped slightly on one side, saying nothing.
"Dinner,"
called Marguerite, pushing her way in from the kitchen with a steaming bowl of spaghetti in her hands.
"Leon, go wash your hands."
There was crusty garlic bread, thick red sauce, good spicy meatballs. Shadow complimented Marguerite on it.
"Old family recipe," she told him, "from the Corsican side of the family."
"I thought you were Native American."
"Dad's Cherokee," said Sam. "Mag's mom's father came from Corsica."
Sam was the only person in the room who was actually drinking the Cabernet.
Dad left her when Megs was 10 and he moved across town. 6 months after that I was born. Mom and Dad got married when the divorce came through. When I was 10, he went away. I think he has a 10-year attention span.
Well, he's been out in Oklahoma for 10 years, said Marguerite.
Now, my mom's family were European Jewish, continued Sam, from one of those places that used to be communist and now are just chaos. I think she liked the idea of being married to a Cherokee, fry bread and chopped liver.
She took another sip of the red wine.
Sam's mom's a wild woman, said Marguerite, semi-approvingly. You know where she is now? Asked Sam.
Shadow shook his head.
She's in Australia. She met a guy on the Internet who lived in Hobart. When they met in the flesh, she decided he was actually kind of icky, but she really liked Tasmania. So she's living down there with a woman's group, teaching them to batik cloth and things like that. Isn't that cool? At her age?
Shadow agreed that it was and helped himself to more meatballs. Sam told them how all the Aboriginal natives of Tasmania had been wiped out by the British, and about the human chain they made across the island to catch them, which trapped only an old man and a sick boy. She told him how the thylacines, the Tasmanian tigers, had been killed by farmers, scared for their sheep, how the politicians in the 1930s noticed that the thylacines should be protected only after the last of them was dead. She finished her second glass of wine, poured a third.
"So, Mike," said Sam, suddenly, her cheeks reddening, "tell us about your family. What are the Ainsells like?"
She was smiling, and there was mischief in that smile. "We're real dull," said Shadow. "None of us ever got as far as Tasmania. So you're at school in Madison. What's that like?"
"You know," she said. "I'm studying art history, women's studies, and casting my own bronzes." "When I grow up," said Leon, "I'm going to do magic. Poof, will you teach me, Mike Ainsell?"
"Sure," said Shadow, "if your mom doesn't mind."
Sam said, "After we've eaten, while you're putting Leon to bed, Mags, I think I'm going to get Mike to take me to the buck stops here for an hour or so."
Marguerite did not shrug. Her head moved, an eyebrow raised slightly.
"I think he's interesting," said Sam, "and we have lots to talk about."
Marguerite looked at Shadow, who busied himself in dabbing an imaginary blob of red sauce from his chin with a paper napkin.
"Well, you're grown-ups," she said, in a tone of voice that implied that they weren't, and that even if they were, they shouldn't be.
After dinner, Shadow helped Sam with the washing up. He dried. And then he did a trick for Leon, counting pennies into Leon's palm. Each time Leon opened his hand and counted them, there was one less coin than he had counted in. And as for the final penny, are you squeezing it tightly? When Leon opened his hand, he found it had transformed into a dime. Leon's plaintive cries of, "How'd you do that? Mama, how'd he do that?" followed him out into the hall. Sam handed him his coat.
"Come on," she said.
Her cheeks were flushed from the wine. Outside, it was cold. Shadow stopped in his apartment, tossed the minutes of the Lakeside City Council into a plastic grocery bag, and brought it along. Hinselman might be down at the buck, and he wanted to show him the mention of his grandfather. They walked down the drive side by side. He opened the garage door, and she started to laugh.
"Oh, my God!" she said when she saw the forerunner. "Paul Gunther's car! You bought Paul Gunther's car! Oh, my God!"
Shadow opened the door for her. Then he went around and got in. "You know the car?"
"When I came up here 2 or 3 years ago to stay with Mags, it was me that persuaded him to paint it purple."
"Oh," said Shadow, "it's good to have someone to blame." He drove the car out onto the street, got out and closed the garage door, got back into the car. Sam was looking at him oddly as he got in, as if the confidence had begun to leak out of her. He put on his seatbelt, and she said,
"Okay. This is a stupid thing to do, isn't it, getting into a car with a psycho killer?"
"I got you safe home last time," said Shadow.
"You killed 2 men," she said. "You're wanted by the feds. And now I find out you're living under an assumed name next door to my sister, unless Mike Ainsell is your real name."
"No," said Shadow, and he sighed. "It's not." He hated saying it. It was as if he was letting go of something important, abandoning Mike Ainsell by denying him. As if he were taking his leave of a friend.
Did you kill those men?
No.
They came to my house and said we'd been seen together, and this guy showed me photographs of you. What was his name? Mr. Hat? No, Mr. Town. It was like The Fugitive. But I said I hadn't seen you.
Thank you.
So, she said, tell me what's going on. I'll keep your secrets if you keep mine.
I don't know any of yours, said Shadow.
Well, you know that it was my idea to paint this thing purple, thus forcing Paul Gunther to become such an object of scorn and derision for several counties around that he was forced to leave town entirely. We were kind of stoned, she admitted.
I doubt that bit of it's much of a secret, said Shadow. Everyone in Lakeside must have known it's a stoner sort of purple.
And then she said, very quiet, very fast, if you're going to kill me, please don't hurt me. I shouldn't have come here with you. I am so fucking dumb. I can identify you, Jesus.
Shadow sighed. I've never killed anybody, really. Now I'm going to take you to the Buck, he said. We'll have a drink, or if you give the word, I'll turn this car around and take you home. Either way, I'll just have to hope you aren't going to call the cops. There was silence as they crossed the bridge.
Who did kill those men? She asked.
You wouldn't believe me if I told you.
I would. She sounded angry now.
He wondered if bringing the wine to the dinner had been a wise idea. Life was certainly not a Cabernet right now. It's not easy to believe.
I, she told him, can believe anything. You have no idea what I can believe.
Really?
I can believe things that are true, and I can believe things that aren't true, and I can believe things where nobody knows if they're true or not. I can believe in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and Marilyn Monroe and the Beatles and Elvis and Mr. Ed. Listen, I believe that people are perfectible. That knowledge is infinite, that the world is run by secret banking cartels and is visited by aliens on a regular basis, nice ones that look like wrinkledy lemurs and bad ones who mutilate cattle and want our water and our women. I believe that the future sucks, and I believe that the future rocks, and I believe that one day White Buffalo Woman is going to come back and kick everyone's ass. I believe that all men are just overgrown boys with deep problems communicating, and that the decline in good sex in America is coincident with the decline in drive-in movie theaters from state to state. I believe that all politicians are unprincipled crooks, and I still believe that they are better than the alternative. I believe that California is going to sink into the sea when the big one comes, while Florida is going to dissolve into madness and alligators and toxic waste. I believe that antibacterial soap is destroying our resistance to dirt and disease so that one day we'll all be wiped out by the common cold, like the Martians in War of the Worlds. I believe that the greatest poets of the last century were Edith Sitwell and Don Marquis, that jade is dried dragon sperm, and that thousands of years ago in a former life I was a one-armed Siberian shaman. I believe that mankind's destiny lies in the stars. I believe that candy really did taste better when I was a kid, that it's aerodynamically impossible for a bumblebee to fly, that light is a wave and a particle, that there's a cat in a box somewhere who's alive and dead at the same time, although if they don't ever open the box to feed it, it'll eventually just be two different kinds of dead. And that there are stars in the universe billions of years older than the universe itself. I believe in a personal God who cares about me and worries and oversees everything I do. I believe in an impersonal God who set the universe in motion and went off to hang with her girlfriends and doesn't even know that I'm alive. I believe in an empty and godless universe of causal chaos, background noise, and sheer blind luck. I believe that anyone who says that sex is overrated just hasn't done it properly. I believe that anyone who claims to know what's going on will lie about the little things, too.
I believe in absolute honesty and sensible social lies. I believe in a woman's right to choose, a baby's right to live, that while all human life is sacred, there's nothing wrong with the death penalty if you can trust the legal system implicitly, and that no one but a moron would ever trust the legal system. I believe that life is a game, that life is a cruel joke, and that life is what happens when you're alive, and that you might as well lie back and enjoy it. She stopped, out of breath. Shadow almost took his hands off the wheel to applaud. Instead, he said, "Okay. So if I tell you what I've learned, you won't think that I'm a nut."
"Maybe," she said. "Try me."
"Would you believe that all the gods that people have ever imagined are still with us today?"
"Maybe."
"And that there are new gods out there, gods of computers and telephones and whatever, and that they all seem to think there isn't room for them both in the world, and that some kind of war is kind of likely?"
"And these gods killed those two men?"
"No. My wife killed those two men."
"I thought you said your wife was dead."
"She is."
"She killed them before she died, then?"
"After. Don't ask." She reached up a hand and flicked her hair from her forehead. They pulled up on Main Street outside the Buck Stops here. The sign over the window showed a surprised-looking stag standing on its hind legs holding a glass of beer. Shadow grabbed the bag with the book in it and got out.
"Why would they have a war?" asked Sam. "It seems kind of redundant. What is there to win?"
"I don't know," admitted Shadow.
"It's easier to believe in aliens than in gods," said Sam. "Maybe Mr. Town and Mr. Whatever were men in black, only the alien kind."
They were standing on the sidewalk outside the Buck Stops here, and Sam stopped. She looked up at Shadow, and her breath hung on the night air like a faint cloud. She said,
"Just tell me you're one of the good guys."
"I can't," said Shadow. "I wish I could, but I'm doing my best." She looked up at him and bit her lower lip. Then she nodded.
"Good enough," she said. "I won't turn you in. You can buy me a beer."
This ends Disc 12. American Gods, Disc 13.
Shadow pushed the door open for her, and they were hit by a blast of heat and music. They went inside. Sam waved at some friends. Shadow nodded to a handful of people whose faces, although not their names, he remembered from the day he had spent searching for Allison McGovern or who he had met in Mabel's in the morning. Chad Mulligan was standing at the bar with his arm around the shoulders of a small red-haired woman, the kissing cousin, Shadow figured. He wondered what she looked like, but she had her back to him. Chad's hand raised in a mock salute when he saw Shadow. Shadow grinned and waved back at him. Shadow looked around for Hintzelman, but the old man didn't seem to be there this evening. He spied a free table at the back and started walking toward it. Then somebody began to scream. It was a bad scream, a full-throated, seen-a-ghost, hysterical scream which silenced all conversation. Shadow looked around, certain somebody was being murdered, and then he realized that all the faces in the bar were turning toward him. Even the black cat who slept in the window during the day was standing up on top of the jukebox, with its tail high and its back arched, and was staring at Shadow. Time slowed.
"Get him!" shouted a woman's voice, parked on the verge of hysteria. "Oh, for God's sake, somebody stop him! Don't let him get away, please!"
It was a voice he knew. Nobody moved. They stared at Shadow. He stared back at them. Chad Mulligan stepped forward, walking through the people. The small woman walked behind him warily, her eyes wide, as if she was preparing to start screaming once more. Shadow knew her. Of course he knew her. Chad was still holding his beer, which he put down on a nearby table. He said, "Mike." Shadow said, "Chad." Audrey Burton took hold of Chad's sleeve. Her face was white, and there were tears in her eyes.
"Shadow," she said, "you bastard, you murderous evil bastard."
"Are you sure that you know this man, hon?" said Chad. He looked uncomfortable. Audrey Burton looked at him incredulously.
"Are you crazy? He worked for Robbie for years. His slutty wife was my best friend. He's wanted for murder. I had to answer questions. He's an escaped convict."
She was way over the top, her voice trembling with suppressed hysteria, sobbing out her words like a soap actress going for a daytime Emmy. "Kissing cousins," thought Shadow, unimpressed. Nobody in the bar said a word. Chad Mulligan looked up at Shadow.
"It's probably a mistake. I'm sure we can sort this all out," he said, sensibly. Then he said to the bar, "It's all fine, nothing to worry about. We can sort this out. Everything's fine."
Then to Shadow, "Let's step outside, Mike." Quiet competence. Shadow was impressed.
"Sure," said Shadow.
He felt a hand touch his hand, and he turned to see Sam staring at him. He smiled down at her as reassuringly as he could. Sam looked at Shadow, then she looked around the bar at the faces staring at them. She said to Audrey Burton, "I don't know who you are, but you are such a cunt." Then she went up on tiptoes and pulled Shadow down to her and kissed him hard on the lips, pushing her mouth against his for what felt to Shadow like several minutes and might have been as long as 5 seconds in real clock-ticking time. It was a strange kiss, Shadow thought, as her lips pressed against his. It wasn't intended for him. It was for the other people in the bar to let them know that she had picked sides. It was a flag-waving kiss. Even as she kissed him, he became certain that she didn't even like him. Well, not like that. Still, there was a tale he had read once long ago as a small boy, the story of a traveler who had slipped down a cliff, with man-eating tigers above him and a lethal fall below him, who managed to stop his fall halfway down the side of the cliff, holding on for dear life. There was a clump of strawberries beside him and certain death above him and below. What should he do? Went the question. And the reply was, eat the strawberries. The story had never made any sense to him as a boy. It did now. So he closed his eyes, threw himself into the kiss, and experienced nothing but Sam's lips and the softness of her skin against his, sweet as a wild strawberry.
"Come on, Mike," said Chad Mulligan firmly. "Please, let's take it outside."
Sam pulled back. She licked her lips and smiled, a smile that nearly reached her eyes.
"Not bad," she said. "You kiss good for a boy. Okay, go play outside."
Then she turned to Audrey Burton. "But you," she said, "are still a cunt." Shadow tossed Sam his car keys. She caught them one-handed. He walked through the bar and stepped outside, followed by Chad Mulligan. A gentle snow had begun to fall, the flakes spinning down into the light of the neon bar sign.
"You want to talk about this?" asked Chad.
Audrey had followed them out onto the sidewalk. She looked as if she were ready to start screaming again. She said,
"He killed 2 men, Chad. The FBI came to my door. He's a psycho. I'll come down to the station with you if you want."
"You've caused enough trouble, ma'am," said Shadow. He sounded tired, even to himself. "Please, go away."
"Chad, did you hear that? He threatened me," said Audrey.
"Get back inside, Audrey," said Chad Mulligan.
She looked as if she were about to argue, then she pressed her lips together so hard they went white and went back into the bar.
"Would you like to comment on anything she said?" asked Chad Mulligan.
"I've never killed anyone," said Shadow.
Chad nodded. "I believe you," he said. "I'm sure we can deal with these allegations easily enough. You won't give me any trouble, will you, Mike?"
"No trouble," said Shadow. "This is all a mistake."
"Exactly," said Chad. "So I figure we ought to head down to my office and sort it all out there."
"Am I under arrest?" asked Shadow.
"Nope," said Chad. "Not unless you want to be. I figure you come with me out of a sense of civic duty, and we'll straighten all this out."
Chad patted Shadow down, found no weapons. They got into Mulligan's car. Again, Shadow sat in the back, looking out through the metal cage. He thought, SOS, Mayday, help. He'd tried to push Mulligan with his mind, as he'd once pushed a cop in Chicago.
"This is your old friend, Mike Ainsel. You saved his life. Don't you know how silly this is? Why don't you just drop the whole thing?"
"I figured it was good to get you out of there," said Chad. "All you needed was some loudmouth deciding that you were Allison McGovern's killer, and we'd have had a lynch mob on our hands."
"Point."
They pulled up outside the Lakeside Police Building, which, Chad said as they pulled up outside it, actually belonged to the county sheriff's department. The local police made do with a few rooms in there. Pretty soon the county would build something modern. For now, they had to make do with what they had. They walked inside.
"Should I call a lawyer?" asked Shadow.
"You aren't accused of anything," said Mulligan. "Up to you." They pushed through some swing doors. "Take a seat over there." Shadow took a seat on the wooden chair with cigarette burns on the side. He felt stupid and numb. There was a small poster on the notice board beside a large no-smoking sign. "Endangered. Missing," it said. The photograph was Allison McGovern's. There was a wooden table with old copies of Sports Illustrated and Newsweek on it. The light was bad. The paint on the wall was yellow, but it might once have been white. After 10 minutes, Chad brought him a watery cup of vending machine hot chocolate. "What's in the bag?" he asked. And it was only then that Shadow realized he was still holding the plastic bag containing the minutes of the Lakeside City Council. "Old book," said Shadow. "Your grandfather's picture's in here, or great-grandfather, maybe."
"Yeah?"
Shadow flipped through the book until he found the portrait of the town council, and he pointed to the man called Mulligan. Chad chuckled.
"If that don't beat all," he said.
Minutes passed, and hours, in that room. Shadow read two of the Sports Illustrateds, and he started in on the Newsweek. From time to time, Chad would come through, once checking to see if Shadow needed to use the restroom, once to offer him a ham roll and a small packet of potato chips.
"Thanks," said Shadow, taking them.
"Am I under arrest yet?" Chad sucked the air between his teeth.
"Well," he said, "not yet. It doesn't look like you came by the name Mike Ainsel legally. On the other hand, you can call yourself whatever you want in this state if it's not for fraudulent purposes. You just hang loose."
"Can I make a phone call?"
"Is it a local call?"
"Long distance."
"It'll save money if I put it on my calling card. Otherwise, you'll just be feeding $10 worth of quarters into that thing in the hall."
"Sure," thought Shadow. "And this way you'll know the number I dialed, and you'll probably be listening in on an extension."
"That would be great," said Shadow.
They went into an empty office. The number Shadow gave Chad to dial for him was that of a funeral home in Cairo, Illinois. Chad dialed it, handed Shadow the receiver.
"I'll leave you in here," he said, and went out.
The telephone rang several times, and it was picked up.
"Jacqueline Ibis, can I help you?"
"Hi, Mr. Ibis, this is Mike Ainsel. I helped out there for a few days over Christmas." A moment's hesitation, then,
"Of course, Mike. How are you?"
"Not great, Mr. Ibis. In a patch of trouble. About to be arrested. Hoping you'd seen my uncle about. Or maybe you could get a message to him."
"I can certainly ask around. Hold on. Mike, there's someone here who wishes a word with you."
The phone was passed to somebody, and then a smoky female voice said,
"Hi, honey. I miss you."
He was certain he'd never heard that voice before. But he knew her. He was sure that he knew her.
"Let it go,"
the smoky voice whispered in his mind, in a dream.
"Let it all go."
"Who's that girl you were kissing, hun? You trying to make me jealous?"
"We're just friends," said Shadow. "I think she was trying to prove a point."
"How did you know she kissed me?" "I got eyes wherever my folk walk," she said. "You take care now, hon."
There was a moment of silence, then Mr. Ibis came back on the line and said,
"Mike?"
"Yes."
"There's a problem getting hold of your uncle. He seems to be kind of tied up, but I'll try and get a message to your Aunt Nancy. Best of luck." The line went dead.
Shadow sat down, expecting Chad to return. He sat in the empty office, wishing he had something to distract him. Reluctantly, he picked up the minutes once more, opened it to somewhere in the middle of the book, and began to read. An ordinance prohibiting expectoration on sidewalks and on the floors of public buildings, or throwing thereon tobacco in any form, was introduced and passed 8-4 in December of 1876. Lemmy Hautala was 12 years old and had, it was feared, wandered away in a fit of delirium on December the 13th, 1876. A search being immediately effected but impeded by the snows which are blinding. The council had voted unanimously to send the Hautala family their condolences. The fire at Olsen's livery stables the following week was extinguished without any injury or loss of life, human or equine. Shadow scanned the closely printed columns. He found no further mention of Lemmy Hautala. And then, on something slightly more than a whim, Shadow flipped the pages forward to the winter of 1877. He found what he was looking for, mentioned as an aside in the January minutes. Jesse Lovat, age not given, a Negro child, had vanished on the night of December 28th. It was believed that she might have been abducted by traveling so-called peddlers. Condolences were not sent to the Lovat family. Shadow was scanning the minutes of winter 1878, when Chad Mulligan knocked and entered, looking shamefaced, like a child bringing home a bad report card. "Mr. Ainsel," he said, "Mike, I'm truly sorry about this. Personally, I like you, but that don't change anything, you know." Shadow said he knew. "I got no choice in the matter," said Chad, "but to place you under arrest for violating your parole." Then Mulligan read Shadow his rights. He filled out some paperwork. He took Shadow's prints. He walked him down the hall to the county jail on the other side of the building. There was a long counter and several doorways on one side of the room, two holding cells and a doorway on the other. One of the cells was occupied. A man slept on a cement bed under a thin blanket. The other was empty. There was a sleepy-looking woman in a brown uniform behind the counter, watching Jay Leno on a small white portable television. She took the papers from Chad and signed for Shadow. Chad hung around, filled in more papers. The woman came around the counter, patted Shadow down, took all his possessions, wallet, coins, front door key, book, watch, and put them on the counter, then gave him a plastic bag with orange clothes in it and told him to go into the open cell and change into them. He could keep his own underwear and socks. He went in and changed into the orange clothes and the shower footwear. It stank evilly in there. The orange top he pulled over his head had Lumber County Jail written on the back in large black letters. The metal toilet in the cell had backed up and was filled to the brim with a brown stew of liquid feces and sour, beerish urine. Shadow came back out, gave the woman his clothes, which she put into the plastic bag with the rest of his possessions. He had thumbed through the wallet before he handed it over. "You take care of this," he had said to the woman. "My whole life is in here." The woman took the wallet from him and assured him that it would be safe with them. She asked Chad if that wasn't true, and Chad, looking up from the last of his paperwork, said Liz was telling the truth. They'd never lost a prisoner's possessions yet. Shadow had slipped the $400 bills that he had palmed from the wallet into his socks when he had changed, along with the silver Liberty dollar he had palmed as he had emptied his pockets. "Say," Shadow asked when he came out, "would it be okay if I finished reading the book?" "Sorry, Mike. Rules are rules," said Chad. Liz put Shadow's possessions in a bag in the back room. Chad said he'd leave Shadow in Officer Butte's capable hands. Liz looked tired and unimpressed. Chad left. The telephone rang, and Liz, Officer Butte, answered it.
"Okay," she said. "Okay. No problem. Okay. No problem. Okay."
She put down the phone and made a face. "Problem?" asked Shadow.
"Yes.
Not really. Kinda. They're sending someone up from Milwaukee to collect you.
Why is that a problem?
I got to keep you in here with me for 3 hours, she said, and the cell over there, she pointed to the cell by the door with the sleeping man in it, that's occupied. He's on suicide watch. I shouldn't put you in with him, but it's not worth the trouble to sign you in to the county and then sign you out again.
She shook her head.
And you don't want to go in there.
She pointed to the empty cell in which he'd changed his clothes.
Because the can is shot. It stinks in there, doesn't it?
Yes, it was gross.
It's common humanity, that's what it is. The sooner we get into the new facilities, it can't be too soon for me. One of the women we had in yesterday must have flushed a tampon away. I tell them not to. We got bins for that. They clog the pipes. Every damn tampon down that John costs the county $100 in plumber's fees. So I can keep you out here if I cuff you. Or you can go in the cell. She looked at him. Your call, she said.
I'm not crazy about them, he said, but I'll take the cuffs. She took a pair from her utility belt, then patted the semi-automatic in its holster as if to remind him that it was there.
Hands behind your back, she said.
The cuffs were a tight fit. He had big wrists. Then she put hobbles on his ankles and sat him down on a bench on the far side of the counter against the wall.
Now, she said, you don't bother me and I won't bother you.
She tilted the television so that he could see it.
Thanks, he said. When we get our new offices, she said, there won't be none of this nonsense.
The Tonight Show finished. An episode of Cheers began. Shadow had never watched Cheers. He had only ever seen one episode of it, the one where Coach's daughter comes to the bar, although he had seen that several times. Shadow had noticed that you only ever catch one episode of shows you don't watch over and over, years apart. He thought it must be some kind of cosmic law. Officer Liz Butte sat back in her chair. She was not obviously dozing, but she was by no means awake. So she didn't notice when the gang at Cheers stopped talking and getting off one-liners and just started staring out of the screen at Shadow. Diane, the blonde barmaid who fancied herself an intellectual, was the first to talk.
Shadow, she said, we were so worried about you. You'd fallen off the world. It's so good to see you again, albeit in bondage and orange couture.
What I figure is, the thing to do, pontificated Bar Boar Cliff, is to escape in hunting season, when everybody's wearing orange anyway. Shadow said nothing.
Ah, cat got your tongue, I see, said Diane. Well, you've led us a merry chase.
Shadow looked away. Officer Liz had begun gently to snore. Carla, the little waitress, snapped,
Hey, jerkwad! We interrupt this broadcast to show you something that's going to make you piss in your friggin' pants. You ready?
The screen flickered and went black. The words, Live Feed, pulsated in white at the bottom left of screen. A subdued female voice said in voiceover, It's certainly not too late to change to the winning side, but you know, you also have the freedom to stay just where you are. That's what it means to be an American. That's the miracle of America. Freedom to believe means the freedom to believe the wrong thing, after all, just as freedom of speech gives you the right to stay silent. The picture now showed a street scene. The camera lurched forward in the manner of handheld video cameras in real-life documentaries. A man with thinning hair, a tan, and a faintly hangdog expression filled the frame. He was standing by a wall, sipping a cup of coffee from a plastic cup, looked into the camera and said,
Terrorists hide behind weasel words like freedom fighter. You and I know that they are murdering scum, pure and simple. We are risking our lives to make a difference.
Shadow recognized the voice. He had been inside the man's head once. Mr. Town sounded different from inside. His voice was deeper, more resonant, but there was no mistaking it. The cameras pulled back to show that Mr. Town was standing outside a brick building on an American street. Above the door was a set square and compass framing the letter G. "In position," said somebody off-screen.
"Let's see if the cameras inside the hall are rolling," said the female voiceover voice.
The words "live feed" continued to blink at the bottom left of the screen. Now the picture showed the interior of a small hall. The room was underlit. Two men sat at a table at the far end of the room. One of them had his back to the camera. The camera zoomed in to them awkwardly. For a moment they were out of focus, and then they became sharp once more. The man facing the camera got up and began to pace like a bear on a chain. It was Wednesday. He looked as if, on some level, he was enjoying this. As they came into focus, the sound came on with a pop. The man with his back to the screen was saying, "We are offering is the chance to end this here and now, with no more bloodshed, no more aggression, no more pain, no more loss of life. Isn't that worth giving up a little?" Wednesday stopped pacing and turned. His nostrils flared. "First," he growled, "you have to understand that you are asking me to speak for all of us, which is manifestly nonsensical. Secondly, what on earth makes you think that I believe that you people are going to keep your word?" The man with his back to the camera moved his head.
"You do yourself an injustice," he said. "Obviously you people have no leaders, but you're the one they listen to. They pay attention to you. And as for keeping my word, well, these preliminary talks are being filmed and broadcast live." And he gestured back toward the camera. "Some of your people are watching as we speak. Others will see videotapes. The camera does not lie."
"Everybody lies," said Wednesday. Shadow recognized the voice of the man with his back to the camera. It was Mr. World, the one who had spoken to Town on the cell phone while Shadow was in Town's head.
"You don't believe," said Mr. World, "that we will keep our word?"
"I think your promises were made to be broken and your oaths to be forsworn, but I will keep my word."
"Safe conduct is safe conduct," said Mr. World, "and a flag of truce is what we agreed. I should tell you, by the way, that your young protege is once more in our custody."
Wednesday snorted. "No," he said, "he's not."
"We were discussing the ways to deal with the coming paradigm shift. We don't have to be enemies, do we?"
Wednesday seemed shaken. He said, "I will do whatever is in my power." Shadow noticed something strange about the image of Wednesday on the television screen. A red glint burned on his left eye, the glass one. The dot left a phosphor dot after image as he moved. He seemed unaware of it. "It's a big country," said Wednesday, marshaling his thoughts. He moved his head, and the red laser pointer dot slipped to his cheek. Then it edged up to his glass eye once more.
"There is room for—"
There was a bang, muted by the television speakers, and the side of Wednesday's head exploded. His body tumbled backward. Mr. World stood up, his back still to the camera, and walked out of shot.
"Let's see that again, in slow motion this time," said the announcer's voice reassuringly.
The words "live feed" became replay. Slowly, now, the red laser pointer traced its bead onto Wednesday's glass eye, and once again the side of his face dissolved into a cloud of blood. Freeze frame.
"Yes, it's still God's own country," said the announcer, a news reporter pronouncing the final tagline. "The only question is, which gods?"
Another voice, Shadow thought that it was Mr. World's, it had that same half-familiar quality, said,
"We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming."
On Cheers, Coach assured his daughter that she was truly beautiful, just like her mother. The telephone rang, and Officer Liz sat up with a start. She picked it up, said,
"Okay. Okay. Yes. Okay."
Put the phone down. She got up from behind the counter and said to Shadow,
"I'm going to have to put you in the cell. Don't use the can. The Lafayette Sheriff's Department should be here to collect you soon."
She removed the cuffs and the hobble, locked him into the holding cell. The smell was worse now that the door was closed. Shadow sat down on the concrete bed, slipped the Liberty Dollar from his sock, and began moving it from finger to palm, from position to position, from hand to hand, his only aim to keep the coin from being seen by anyone who might look in. He was passing the time. He was numb. He missed Wednesday, then, sudden and deep. He missed the man's confidence, his attitude, his conviction. He opened his hand, looked down at Lady Liberty,